Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to the program. This week we're playing a Grand Rounds lecture that I gave in Calgary, Alberta, in Canada on October the 6th, 2008. Grand Rounds is the weekly medical meeting to which every doctor attends to learn about the latest in nephrology or neurology or whatever. This time they learnt specifically about the medical implications of nuclear power. This subject has obsessed me for the last 37 years. It is quite complex and detailed, as you are about to hear, but it is imperative, absolutely, that the medical profession, the general public, and the politicians understand these complex but terribly important facts. For if they do not, the nuclear industry will proceed apace and over time will induce epidemics of malignancy in hundreds of thousands of children and genetic diseases for the rest of time. I've just completed a 5-week tour of Canada and the United States, visiting politicians, talking to the media, and giving speeches in public auditoriums, churches, and the hospitals. Thank you. Alberta's quite famous around the world because you're sort of partly the Wild West and partly you've got lots of oil and coal and tar sands and you've got some uranium, but the province next to you has a lot of uranium. I've just revised my book, If You Love This Planet, which was named after the film. I wrote it in 91, predicting from the scientific literature what would happen about global warming, deforestation, desertification, overpopulation, ozone depletion and the like. In that time since 91, everything I wrote has come to pass. And I felt like calling the book I Told You So. I always feel when I write a book, that's it. Everyone will read it. And they'll do the appropriate things, as we do in medicine, to save our patients. But unfortunately, that turns out not to be true. As I revised the book, I read the literature on global warming, the IPCC report, International Panel on Climate Change report, which in fact is 3 years old because the global scientists were so meticulous and pedantic, they went over every single word and every single sentence till they agreed upon it. So it's a little bit outdated. I also read James Hansen's work. He's at the Goddard Space Center, NASA. He coined the term global warming 20 years ago when he testified before the Senate. Hansen's predictions about global warming are more severe than the IPCC. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we had 250 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're now up to 383 parts per million. Hansen says we've got to go backwards to 350 parts per million for several reasons. One, the Arctic ice is melting. They've just measured it and it's thinner now than it's ever been. Summer ice melt. It is predicted by some it will be gone in the summer by 2010. Now, what happens is when that occurs, you get the albedo flip. Albedo means that the white light from the sun comes down onto the ice and it's projected back or reflected back into the universe, so the Earth, you know, it doesn't heat. Normally, when the white light from the sun hits the Earth, it's converted to infrared radiation and trapped by the atmosphere. And particularly when CO2 collects in the atmosphere, it acts as glass does in a glass house and traps the infrared radiation. Now, if the ice melts totally, you will get the albedo flip, which is, instead of the white light being reflected back, you've got black sea. And the black sea absorbs the heat and the sea heats. Right next to that is Greenland. The ice cap on Greenland is 3 kilometres thick. The Greenland ice cap is melting. Rivers are forming on the top. The water's spreading down through the Greenland ice cap and getting to the surface of the rock, which acts as a lubricant. So the ice is starting to move towards the sea. There are earthquakes induced quite frequently now in Greenland by huge glaciers breaking off from the Greenland ice cap. If the Greenland ice cap melts, we're in serious trouble. But the predictions are, even if it doesn't quite melt, that the seas will rise 5 metres by the end of this century. 5 metres is 15 feet. But that's probably minimal. It's probably going to be much more. Now, along with that heating of the sea, Antarctic is in trouble too, huge ice shelves are breaking off from the Antarctic. But there's permafrost. And the permafrost has been there for hundreds of thousands of years. And the permafrost has trapped huge quantities of methane. Methane is 20 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2. CO2 is responsible for 50% of global warming. And then if we get the methane released, like millions of tons from the permafrost in the tundra and the like, and it's starting to melt. If you go up to Alaska, where Sarah Palin hails from, the trees are sort of drunken trees at odd angles as the permafrost is melting. If the permafrost melts, and the IPCC didn't talk about these delayed effects of the albedo flip and the permafrost melts, we're in serious trouble. And from all indications, it seems like it's happening. So I come to Alberta. This huge city is built upon oil, right? I hear that the Americans have come and taken over most of your oil companies, so you are sycophants to the United States, which burns oil voraciously, as you know. The truth is that you have a huge responsibility. As James Hansen said, we must stop burning coal now. Coal is the most concentrated form of carbon there is and produces huge quantities of CO2. And by 2030, we must absolutely stop burning coal, but we've got to stop burning oil. As the Earth heats, so the oceans rise, so there will be more and more catastrophic storms with greater frequency. For instance, Bangladesh is built on a delta. Oh, and also the glaciers are melting rapidly, so the rivers like the Ganges and the Yellow River, etc., will be drying up. So there will be a huge scarcity of water, B, the oceans rise, catastrophic storms, and places like the Delta will be drowned. And one third of the human race lives at sea level. Some of the most beautiful cities on Earth are at sea level, and they will drown, and we will have millions of ecological refugees. Millions moving into higher territory, into sort of societies which are well formed and organized, and the ecological refugees will create havoc, of course. The other thing is, as the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer enlarge north and south, and the tropics enlarge north and south, we'll be seeing malaria in Seattle, maybe up here, as the Anopheles mosquitoes breed in their trillions. So we'll get malaria, eastern equine encephalitis, dengue fever and the like, epidemics like we've never seen before in medicine. Then we can talk about droughts. We're seeing the droughts now in Australia. We're in the middle of a huge drought. Our ex-Prime Minister John Howard wanted to build 25 reactors in a drought-stricken country. Each nuclear reactor uses 1 million gallons a minute of water to keep it cool, and you want to build 4 of them. Up, ironically, at a place called Peace River. So I really want to lay it upon you as my colleagues that we're talking about the ultimate form of preventive medicine now. We have to stop global warming. Now, people say, well, it's impossible. You know, we have to have energy. Well, first of all, generations of people for, I don't know how long we've been here, 3 million years, 2 million years, lived without electricity. Mozart wrote by candlelight. Shakespeare wrote by candlelight. Yeah, we've gotten used to it and we turn our computers on, we leave everything on overnight, all those lights blinking, etc. That uses 6% of the power that we use just by leaving those things on overnight. But we can conserve 20% of that which we use. For instance, none of us should be using clothes dryers. We should be hanging our clothes out and drying them with the nuclear reactor in the sky in the summer and in the basements by the furnace in the winter. That's easy. They use up to 10% of the electricity that you use. Why do we use clothes dryers? Because General Electric, which makes good things for life like clothes dryers and refrigerators and washing machines and nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons, has produced a market for their electricity. I'm being semi-facetious, but it's true. There are many ways that conservation can take place, but we can conserve 20% of the electricity we use. I commissioned a study a year ago. I had a wonderful conference on nuclear power and global warming and had people from both sides of the issue, including that Patrick Moore man, who I think hails from Canada, who used to be opposed to nuclear power, and then he said he founded Greenpeace and now he works for the nuclear industry. And we had a very excellent discussion for 2 days. And then finally a man stood up at the end called David Freeman, who used to run TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, who closed down 6 reactors, who worked with Jimmy Carter in the White House and put the solar panels on the White House and turned the thermostat down. He stood up at the end and said, we can generate all the electricity and energy we need with no nuclear and no carbon. And I said, you must be joking. He said, no, I'm not. So I commissioned a study which was done by one of his proteges, Arjun Makajani, called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. And it's very complex, beautifully done, costing everything out. By 2050, America can be carbon free, nuclear free. For instance, we can put solar panels on every parking lot in America, and that's a huge area. They're building cars now, electric cars with lithium-ion batteries that can be recharged 100,000 times. You plug your car in when you go to work, car charges up, you unplug it, and you take it home at night and plug it into the house and charge up your house. It's called vehicle-to-grid, vehicle-to-grid. Wind. You are blown by wind. You know, you've probably got enough wind in this province alone to supply the whole of Canada with electricity. You are bathed in sun, and it's not one source that will provide all the energy that is needed, but a multifactorial source of geothermal, which will provide baseline, and you've got a lot of geothermal here and across Canada. So wind, tidal, solar and the like, and these energy systems are developing so rapidly that Silicon Valley and the entrepreneurs are into it. They call it green energy, not because it's green, but because it makes lots of greenbacks. And that's the one part of Wall Street is not suffering at the moment. I advise you to read this book. In fact, this is the prescription for survival. It's beautifully done, very scientific, and costed out. So when you hear the nuclear industry and the oil industry say that there are no alternatives, they're either ignorant and haven't read the data and literature, or they're lying. This is a medical problem. This is the ultimate form of preventive medicine to stop global warming. I read today an article in the Washington Post which said that of the 2,400 mammals in the world, or thereabouts, 25 to 36% are threatened with extinction soon. Extinction. And how many millions of years did it take those mammals to evolve? I mean, it makes me feel like weeping. The lions and the tigers and the elephants. And it's a combination of events like loss of habitat and overpopulation of this particular species. In the year 1800, there were 1 billion human beings. There are now 6.5 billion. Exponential growth. So we're in serious trouble, and I see little evidence that we can control our impulses, both in a reproductive sense or in an ecological sense, and we can fix this. We can fix overpopulation. We know how to do it. if we don't have people like the evangelical Christians running the White House. That's facetious too, but you know what I mean. Okay, so I want to move on from global warming because I really wanted you to understand that it's inappropriate to be selling oil now. It's inappropriate to be mining those tar sands. For each 3 barrels of oil you get out, you use 2 barrels of oil in energy to boil the soil, to boil the sand, to extract the oil. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. And we've got to stop burning oil. You've got coal, you mustn't dig it up. And there's uranium in the province next door. Now let's get on to the main issue at hand, and that's nuclear power. I want to walk you through the medical implications of the nuclear fuel cycle, and I wrote this book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, about 1.5 years ago. First, I want to tell you that nuclear power induces global warming in its own right. If you take the whole fuel cycle from uranium mining, and I live in a country where 40% of the world's richest uranium resides, they use a huge amount of fossil fuel to mine millions of tons of uranium to fuel one reactor. Then they crush the uranium, it's called milling, more fossil fuel. Our uranium is enriched in Paducah, Kentucky, where they use 2 1,500-megawatt coal-fired plants to generate the electricity to enrich the uranium. Furthermore, the uranium is converted to uranium hexafluoride, which is a gas, to be forced through tiny micropores to enrich it, and I'll get into that in a minute. And it's a very hot process. That gas, uranium hexafluoride, is very hot. So they have hundreds of miles of pipes with the gas in it, and they use CFC gas to cool the pipes. Now, CFC is banned under the Montreal Protocol. It's 10 to 20,000 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2, and it destroys the ozone. So people have stopped making it. But the nuclear industry has been grandfathered out of the Montreal Protocol. Classic American politics. And 92% of the CFC gas that is emerging in the United States comes from that enrichment plant. That's not factored into global warming when the nuclear industry say they're emission-free, which they are not. Then you have to build the reactor. To make cement is hugely energy-consuming and produces massive quantities of CO2 in its own right. Then you've got storage of waste and the like. If you take the whole nuclear fuel chain right through to storage of waste for 500,000 years, nuclear power at the moment produces 30% of the CO2 as a similar-sized gas-fired plant, but as the uranium declines in concentration and we use the best uranium, within 1 or 2 decades, so much energy will go into the fuel cycle that nuclear power will produce the same amount of CO2 as a similar-sized gas-fired plant. So you may as well just burn the gas. So the nuclear industry are using global warming as a camouflage and as an excuse, as a renaissance for their industry. I may tell you that your industry is telling you that your 4 reactors, 1,000 megawatt reactors, which are huge, each will use 1 million gallons of water a minute to keep it cool. The water comes out relatively radioactive. They say that the 4 reactors will cost $10 billion in toto. That's also fallacious. In America, they're saying now that reactors will cost $12 to $15 billion to produce each. Samuel Bodman, who's the Secretary of Energy in the United States, is now saying the meltdown in Wall Street means probably they won't be able to build nuclear power plants because the government in America pays for them all, and so does yours. So nuclear power is a socialized industry, totally socialized. What's more, you pay for the insurance too. You can't buy private insurance against a nuclear accident, which really says it all. So I doubt at this stage that it will continue. Nuclear power is a prodigal son of the weapons industry. I knew a lot of the men in the Manhattan Project. They felt so guilt-ridden about killing and vaporizing 220,000 people in Japan that they thought they could harness the atom for peace. They called it sunshine units. But they all knew, actually, the dangers, and they were incredibly guilt-ridden. They're dead now. Okay, so let's start with uranium mining because you're involved in that, as are we. There are 2 isotopes, 235, that's the fissionable one, present 0.7% in the ore, and 238 is the one that is not fissionable. Uranium decays to a series of daughters over time. One of them is radon gas, which is an alpha emitter. There are basically five sorts of radiation: X-rays we're familiar with, gamma radiation we're familiar with, alpha radiation, which is a particulate form of radiation composed of two protons and two neutrons, doesn't travel far. You can hold an alpha emitter in your hand. It doesn't penetrate the epidermis to damage living dermal cells. However, if it gets into the body by ingestion or inhalation, it's extremely mutagenic and carcinogenic. Beta radiation is an electron emitted from an unstable atom. And then you've got neutrons. I won't go into that now, but neutrons are extremely mutagenic and dangerous. So radon is an alpha emitter. Men who mine uranium inhale radon. Masks will not prevent the inhalation of radon, such that in the past 30 to 50% of men who've mined uranium have developed lung cancer and died. Radium is another daughter. Radium killed Madame Curie of leukemia. It's a bone seeker. It's a calcium analog. It's an alpha emitter. And she died of leukemia. She used to walk around with a little bit of radium in her lab coat pocket, playing with it. Her daughter also died of leukemia. We used to use radium in medicine. There's a very big medical literature on radium. The ore face itself continually emits gamma radiation, so men who mine uranium are exposed to low doses of gamma, including their testicles, the most important organs in a male body. And so therefore, that's how I stopped uranium mining in Australia, by telling the miners about this and their testicles, and their wives also got pretty activated and dragged them away from mining uranium. So there are three forms of exposure to radiation in uranium miners. So that itself is dangerous. In Australia, we can't get in now to talk to the unions and the workers about the medical hazards associated with their job. Uranium-238 is a byproduct of uranium for nuclear power, and it's called depleted uranium, DU. It's depleted only of 235, not of radiation and its daughters. It is because it's waste, it's free. It's 1.7 times more dense than lead, and the Pentagon have found it extremely useful to produce shells of depleted uranium, because remember, in your physics class, momentum equals mass by velocity. So if the mass is large, you have a tremendously powerful weapon. So America uses DU shells made of 10 pounds, 5 kilos, as anti-tank shells. They've used it in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and they used it first in 1991-2 in a town near Basra. They used 360 tons of it, and it has certain properties. It's very reactive, and when a shell hits a tank, it's pyrophoric, and it bursts into flame, and up to 80% of it is volatilized and turned into particles less than 5 microns of respirable size. So that's in itself very dangerous. So what happened was, this material was scattered in particulate fine form onto the desert floor, and the children played in the empty tanks, and the children are close to the ground inhaling this material. There are a lot of sandstorms in Iraq and the like. 4 years after the intervention in Iraq, our colleagues noticed an increased incidence of childhood cancer. And they followed it. And because of the sanctions and the war, they couldn't treat their patients. They had no drugs, chemotherapeutic drugs. The incidence now of childhood cancer in Basra has gone up 700%. There are also severe congenital anomalies occurring, and encephaly, phocomelia, mid-face deformities and the like. And the incidence of those deformities has also gone up 7%, such that women are too terrified now to deliver their babies. The fact is that uranium is a heavy metal. It's excreted through the kidney. It can cause renal carcinoma. It is a bone seeker, so it can cause bone cancer, osteogenic sarcoma and leukemia. It is excreted also in the semen, interestingly. Veterans from the Iraq War, some of them are having children who are deformed. Now, in this particular intervention, they've used over 2,000 tons of the material. The Pentagon's very cagey and won't say how much. much of it used in Baghdad, where the 5 million population, half of whom are children. Children are 10 to 20 times more radio sensitive, as we know, than adults, because their cells are mitosing rapidly and as such are very sensitive to radiation. So that's uranium mining, and that's DU weapons. It's very hard to get anything in the media about DU weapons. I wrote an article for the New York Times about it. I thought it was an okay article, got well edited, and they wrote back and said, we are unable to publish this, sort of passive tense. Who said they couldn't? They didn't. I think that some journalists see this as complicated, they don't understand it, the Pentagon says it's all fine. There's a huge medical literature on uranium because we used to use it in medicine. We used to give it to patients. The half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. So in truth, we, you, and Australians, coalition of the willing, right, and Americans are conducting a nuclear war in Iraq, but there are no explosions. I wrote this book a couple of years ago called The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex, quoting Pentagon literature about how dangerous uranium is as a weapon. There is a big literature on it. That's only one chapter in the book. So actually, it's an interesting cover. George Bush with Dick Cheney and Colin Powell smiling with the mushroom cloud overhead. When I first wrote the book, they had that cover, but it was just after 9/11, and people said if the book was published with that cover, they would never talk to me again. Some Americans said they would sue me. Remember the patriotism? Then a couple of years later, we were able to use the original cover. Okay, so the uranium is then crushed, and it's turned into uranium hexafluoride, as I told you, and it's enriched. They have a big nickel, huge nickel plate with tiny micropore filters, and on one side is 238, and you pass the gas through, and you then enrich the 235. You enrich it from 0.7% to 3% for use in nuclear power. However, if you enrich it over 50%, you can make nuclear weapons with it, and the Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb. That's why they're worried about Iran, because once you have an enrichment facility, you can make nuclear weapons with enriched uranium. But more, when you fission uranium, you make plutonium, which is excellent fuel for nuclear weapons, and I'll get into that in a minute. This nickel, actually, they've got quite a lot of it. It's radioactive, but it's also valuable. Nickel's valuable, so they're recycling it. They've got a term now in America called below regulatory concern, BRC, and they're recycling it into children's teeth braces, hip replacements, belt buckles, jewelry, cutlery, and furniture. BRC. And all your smoke detectors contain americium-241, which is more toxic than plutonium. I'll get into that in a while. Okay, so you enrich the uranium, you turn it into little ceramic pellets like pieces of chalk, you pack it into fuel rods 12 feet long and half an inch thick like curtain rods. And these fuel rods made of zirconium are taken along to the reactor and packed into the reactor core 100 tons of fuel rods. And between the rods are moderating rods of boron, which moderate the flux of neutrons. The whole thing is immersed in water. The moderating rods are removed slowly. The material, 100 tons of it, reaches critical mass. The neutrons start flying apart and breaking the uranium atoms in spontaneous ways, and 200 new elements are formed, none of which existed before man fissioned the atom. This, of course, creates tremendous heat. The heat boils the water. The steam is taken off in a pipe which turns a turbine which generates electricity. So all a nuclear power plant is designed to do is to boil water. I read a wonderful quote from Einstein the other day which said, he said, nuclear power's a hell of a way to boil water. Now, you use 1 million gallons a minute of water to keep it cool, and in fact, with global warming, you need to think about what's happening. In France, 2 or 3 years ago, there was a heat wave and the rivers were lowered and there wasn't enough water to keep the reactors cool, and the water was too hot. It has to be at a certain temperature to keep the reactor cool, so they had to shut down a lot of the reactors. Many reactors are built at sea level, and as the seas rise, they will be flooded, the control rooms, and there'll be meltdowns. if there is a meltdown, well, there's an interesting thing called the bathtub curve, which applies both to humans and nuclear power plants. In the first few months or years of life with a human or a power plant, they're subjected to irregularities and problems. Babies can develop meningitis and encephalitis and pneumonia and various things, although we have controlled many of those diseases now. Similarly, nuclear power plants are at risk for multiple abnormalities, and in fact Chernobyl and Three Mile Island occurred in the first few months of life. Then through the middle of life, we're pretty stable. And with a reactor and us, the reactor's pipes become embrittle because of the intense neutron radiation. They start to crack and fall apart. Similarly, our pipes become embrittled like me. So like a reactor, I'm aging too and my pipes are getting abnormal. So a reactor only lasts for about 30 years before it must be shut down. But in America, they're extending the life of reactors because they're making a lot of money. For another 20 years. That's very dangerous. They're also putting more highly enriched uranium in, not 3%, but 4.5%, and pumping up the power level. And the reactors are actually vibrating and pipes are falling apart because they're pushing up the power. That's to make more money. There are 103 reactors in the United States. And I don't know how many reactors in Canada. About 20. You've got about 20. Your reactors are terribly dangerous. CANDU reactors. They make very pure plutonium and use unenriched uranium. Plutonium's a fuel for nuclear weapons, and India made her first bomb from your CANDU reactor in 1974. Every year, one-third of the fuel is removed, 30%, because it's so full of fission products it becomes inefficient. And it's put in what are euphemistically called swimming pools, either on the roof of the reactor or beside the reactor. And the fuel rods are removed by remote control and cranes and stacked or racked on the on these racks. And this has to be kept continuously cool too. So if you're a terrorist, if you have a shoulder-held missile and hit the concrete of the cooling pool, it would lose its water and there could be a meltdown in a cooling pool, which has far more radiation in it, like 20 times more radiation than the reactor itself, which contains as much radiation as that released by 1,000 Hiroshima bombs. There's a very good study from Princeton that I have referenced in this book about meltdowns in cooling pools. Now, if there's a meltdown in a reactor, and there was one at Chernobyl, what happens? At Chernobyl, one-third of the fuel was released. And this is a map of Europe. Chernobyl's just here. And the dark pink areas are the very high levels of radioactive fallout. The lighter pink areas are less so. And you can see that the whole area in 360 degrees experienced very high fallout. So the wind changed many times during the time it was burning for over 10 days. But if you look at the whole of Europe, actually, Austria got a fairly high level of fallout. Scandinavia did too, and I was there shortly after the accident. And the cesium-137 actually concentrates highly in the lichen, and the reindeer eat the lichen, and stupidly, I ate reindeer. There was a lot of fallout occurred in Turkey. I'm not sure. I think Turkey's over here. Such that Turkish herbs and Turkish food is relatively radioactive. Also, a lot of fallout occurred in Wales and Cumbria. And recently, the British government went to the farmers up there who are growing lambs and said, you have to close down your farm. Your lambs are radioactive. And the farmer said, well, how long do I have to close my farm down? They said, oh, about 100 years. But it's not at 600 years. What I need to point out is that the various isotopes that were released, and I'll walk you through the isotopes now, just four of them, to give you an indication of what I'm talking about. One of them is strontium-90, which has a half-life of 28 years, so it's dangerous for 600 years. It is a calcium analog and a bone seeker, induces osteogenic sarcoma and leukemia. Cesium-137 is a potassium analog, ubiquitous. It induces brain tumours, rhabdomyosarcomas and the like. Its half-life is 30 years. It's around for 600 years. A huge amount of cesium escaped from Chernobyl plus other emissions. But I want to point out that many of these areas are contaminated with cesium and other elements. I rang the man in Melbourne who tests the food imported from Europe. And I said, how do you test the food? He said, oh, we do random spot checks of various batches. And I said, how do you pick out the ones to test? He said, the computer does. So a lot is untested. I said, what do you do when you find radioactive food? He said, oh, we dilute it with non-radioactive food. If you know anything about the biological cycle of radioactive isotopes and the bioconcentration in the food chain, the solution to pollution by dilution when it comes to radiation is fallacious. Because, for instance, when the cooling water gets back into the rivers or lakes or wherever it's obtained, it contains tritium, which is extraordinary. It's a soft energy beta. It's highly mutagenic. And it combines with an oxygen molecule to produce tritiated water. And this bioconcentrates in the food chain by orders of magnitude at each step, algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish. And you can't taste radioactive elements, as we know, and they're invisible and they're odorless. So we don't know we're ingesting them. And in fact, because of the latent period of carcinogenesis, 5 to 60 years, that's why the nuclear industry can do what they do with impunity, because no one knows which cancers are caused by what. The etiology isn't declared by the cancer per se. And to find out if, in fact, that nuclear power is inducing increased incidences of cancer and the like, you have to do epidemiological studies and follow the exposed populations till they die and do autopsies on all of them. And there haven't been many studies, although recently they've done a very good study in Germany around all their old reactors and found a higher than normal incidence of malignancy in populations living around reactors. So I don't eat European food because I don't know which food, you know, Spanish olive oil or Italian tomatoes or the like, is radioactive. So I don't do it. And I think it is medically contraindicated to eat European food. However, what do the Europeans eat? Remember how frightened they were after the accident. But then, you know, they've got to eat. So they practice what we call psychic numbing and eat their food. But it's tragic that one accident can produce radioactive material that hangs around for 600 years. And it's little talked about. Oh, and the nuclear industry says that only 36 people died at Chernobyl or thereabouts. The fact is that the International Atomic Energy Agency has an agreement with the WHO. WHO can't study radiological accidents from a medical perspective unless the IAEA gives permission. So there's been a huge cover-up in Chernobyl. There have been over 8,000 cases of thyroid cancers and people have had total thyroidectomies, many more now occurring as a result of the I-131 that got out. I-131, we all know about that, but its half-life is 8 days and it's around for 6 weeks. Incidentally, 8 days, 6 weeks. A lot of I-131 got out at Three Mile Island. The monitors measuring the radiation went off scale in the first few minutes because so much got out. So no one knows how much got out, but Hershey's Chocolates is 13 miles from Three Mile Island. That's where they grow the milk, very rich dairying area. The milk was so full of I-131, they powdered the milk for the I-131 to decay 6 weeks, and then they used it for the chocolates. However, we don't know, and they haven't released the ground measurements for strontium, cesium and the like, so we don't know what other materials are sitting on the paddocks where the cows graze, and they will be bioconcentrated in the grass, and the cows eat the grass, and it's bioconcentrated in the cow's milk, and then it gets into our bodies. I've been saying for years, don't eat Hershey's chocolates, and they haven't sued me yet. I think if they did, they would be sorry, because it would advertise what's going on. Now, tritium is routinely released from reactors. Tritiated water is such that if you're immersed in a cloud of fog with an inversion system near the reactor, the tritiated water goes straight through your skin, and skin lets very few elements through, but tritium gets through. Tritium's inhaled into the lung too, and it's ubiquitous. It actually combines with the DNA molecule, so it's highly mutagenic. Reactors continually emit radiation as they operate. These are called routine releases, and some of the elements they release are krypton, argon, and xenon. These are noble gases. They don't combine biochemically in the body except that they are absorbed well through the alveoli. And I used to use xenon in ventilation perfusion scans with the CF patients. Xenon is now used actually to trace and delineate fat deposits. So these elements actually are very fat soluble, and they tend to migrate to the upper to the fat pad in the abdomen and upper thighs where the gonads are situated, and they're very high energy gammas. So people living near reactors, A, they shouldn't grow food because the elements, particularly tritium, bioconcentrates in food, vegetables and fruit. Krypton converts to strontium, xenon converts to cesium, decays. The last element I want to talk about, other elements are routinely released too, is plutonium, which is why they first fissioned uranium, named after the god of hell, not the dog. It's an alpha emitter. It was called by Glenn Seaborg, who discovered it, the most dangerous material known. Less 10 to the minus 6 grams is carcinogenic, but when injected into beagle dogs, they didn't find a dose low enough, 10 to the minus 9 grams, for instance, that didn't give all the dogs cancer. So it's extraordinarily mutagenic. It's an iron analog, interestingly. It tends to get into the body via inhalation, so it can cause lung cancer. It's transferred by macrophages to the mediastinal lymph glands, where it can cause lymphoma. It's transferred to the liver, where it induces liver cancer, bone, because the hemoglobin, red blood cells are made there, bone cancer and leukemia. It's not absorbed in the gut, except it is absorbed better in chlorinated water and in neonates whose gut is immature. It has a predilection for testicles, and it tends to deposit next to the spermatogonia, irradiating the sperm, and as the mutations are passed on generation to generation, takes up to 20 generations for recessive mutations to express themselves, and there are over 16,000 genetic diseases now described. So the genetic mutations are passed on, and the plutonium lives on to get into testicle after testicle if the man is cremated for the rest of time. Many males in the Northern Hemisphere already have a small load of plutonium in their testicles because it's continually falling down still from the weapons testing days from the stratosphere. Okay, plutonium. So it's incredibly carcinogenic, and its half-life is 24,400 years. Each reactor makes 250 kilos of plutonium per year. 5 kilos is critical mass, and in the Manhattan Project, one of the physicists brought two hemispheres together of 2.5 kilos each, and there was a blinding flash, and he disappeared, and so did his fellow scientists in the lab. It reached critical mass. So in other words, any country that buys your uranium, our uranium, and develops reactors has a bomb factory. And that means proliferation of nuclear weapons. All of this material, America's got 64,000 tons of radioactive waste. They don't know what to do with it. They found a mountain in Nevada called Yucca Mountain, which is transected by 30 earthquake faults. It's made of pumice, which is very permeable. That's where they want to put this waste. And that would require 1,300 shipments per year for the next 30 years of radioactive waste, and that's called the Mobile Chernobyl Bill, because if you want to destroy Chicago, you find out when the waste is going through, you aim a missile at the waste container, it bursts, out comes the radiation, and much of Chicago will be contaminated. That's only the waste they have now, but they keep making more. I read you have 34,000 tons of waste, but that seems pretty high. I don't know exactly how much waste you have. No one knows where to put it. And this waste over time, strontium, cesium, plutonium, americium, curium, einsteinium, neptunium, all the rest of them, will leak into water supplies, seep and leak, and bioconcentrate back in the food. And you can imagine generations hence, the babies being born maybe with teratogenic deformities, maybe with genetic disease, the breast milk radioactive, people living near these facilities, and children getting cancer at the age of 6 instead of 60. So in other words, nuclear power is medically contraindicated. The nuclear industry is using Hill & Knowlton, which did the advertising for tobacco, to do their advertising. Remember those eight men who stood in Congress with their hands over their hearts and said tobacco doesn't cause cancer? Well, smoking only kills the smoker. We're talking about a legacy that we leave to our descendants for the rest of time, which will produce random compulsory genetic engineering forevermore, and literally epidemics of malignancy, particularly in children. And we're not the only species with genes, not the only species that get cancer. All species do, plants and animals. So this started with making nuclear weapons, and then they harnessed it to generate electricity. So you can see that this is will pose one of the greatest public health hazards the world will ever see. I just want to end with nuclear weapons. They talk about Iran, you know, maybe getting a bomb and rogue nations. In fact, of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97% of them. So the real rogue nations who threaten life on the planet with destruction are Russia and America. They have thousands of weapons on hair trigger alert, ready to go with the press of the button. George Bush gets a 3-minute decision time, and he's not the brightest. And if he's woken up, you know, at 3 a.m, this is an ad that Hillary Clinton used with the red phone, does he come out of REM for sleep and make the right decision? In fact, the only decision he has is not whether to use them, but how to use them. Counter value, target all the cities in Russia, and since the Cold War ended, America's now targeted China. Counter force, which is to target all the missile silos, or both. And America's still got a plan, and you're part of it with NORAD, to fight and win a nuclear war against Russia. How do you do that when there are only 240 major cities in the Northern Hemisphere and America's got 5,500 weapons ready to go and Russia's got 2,500? Well, you do this. You send one missile over and you decapitate Putin and Moscow so he can't press his button. Then you send over all the missiles, which are terribly accurate, 2 bombs per missile silo, and knock out the missiles before they're launched. The fact that it will kill millions of people is beside the point. That's called collateral damage by the Pentagon. The Russians are worried that they'll lose the nuclear war, so they've made a big cave inside the Urals with one missile called the Dead Hand. And if, in fact, Putin is decapitated, they launch the Dead Hand, and that sends a radio signal to all the missiles to be launched before America strikes the missile silos. No human input. All done by computer. The Russian early warning system hardly works anymore. Their satellites don't work. They're clinically paranoid, as well they would be, knowing what the Pentagon's policy is. Nobody is talking about this. It could happen tonight. When I wrote this book and summarized all the near misses we've had, and, you know, on 9/11, we got to the second highest state of nuclear alert, DEFCON 2, because no one knew what was happening. And they automatically go ready to launch and get their keys out of the things to stick them in the locks and launch. While George Bush is flying around, no one knowing what to do with him in Air Force One. So when I gathered the data and collated it, I, as a physician, you know, as we do with patients, I didn't know how we're still here. I really don't. Luck. And, you know, people say, well, it stopped nuclear war, having these weapons. Well, I'm reminded when I was in CAS, when I just graduated, and an old man came in, he was 80, and he said, I've been driving for 60 years and I've never had an accident. That night he broke his neck. And if there is a nuclear war and we get nuclear winter and the Earth's enveloped with a cloud of smoke so thick it blocks out the sun for years and there's a short ice age and everything but the cockroaches and the algae die, there'll be no one to write the history. I've been harping on about this for I don't know how long. And it's more dangerous now than it ever has been. With these neocons in the White House, I don't know what'll happen if John McCain gets in. And we're part of it. We've got Pine Gap in the middle of Australia that orchestrates the killing in Iraq, is orchestrating missile defense. We're part of that, which is very provocative to Russia and China. They say, if you've got missile defense, we'll build more weapons. And they're doing it right now. NATO is enlarging right up to the Russian borders. This is medical. It's etiology. And that's really upsetting the Russians. That's why they went into Georgia. Can you imagine if Russia came over here and took over Canada, how the Americans would react? They nearly blew up the world when Russia put a few missiles in Cuba. It's very provocative. And no one's taking into account the psychology of these men on both sides, the real etiology of the problem of nuclear war. So we're in a very invidious position. It's the elephant in the sitting room that's never mentioned by anybody. And we practice a kind of psychic numbing or manic denial. We do everything else. Displacement activity. You put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation. They run away and do something irrelevant to that which threatens them. We're doing it every day. Someone asked me today at the... And also America's weaponizing space. They're putting weapons in space to fight war from space. Rods from God, titanium rods that will take out cities and ships and the like. Anti-satellite weapons. And that's very provocative because that's provoking China and Russia too. So everything they're doing, and who's leading it? Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, they're all into it, ripping off the tax dollars. So, and you're part of NORAD, you're part of this whole thing. This is the final epidemic of the human race. Not just the human race, all life on the earth. And to deny it and to be so busy in medicine with our individual patients while ignoring this major threat is like treating the boil on the patient, the face of the patient dying of metastatic anaplastic carcinoma. And as more countries get the bomb, the more the international situation is destabilized. We have to take the lead again. We have to become political. That's how we practice preventive medicine. Remember the Broad Street pump and the cholera epidemic in London? One doctor realized that if we turned off the Broad Street pump, the cholera would go away. It took, I don't know, many months to get the politicians to turn off the pump. But it was political. The answer was political. Now I'm going to show you one last thing. America's got 14 Trident submarines at sea, silently roaming the oceans with nuclear reactors propelling them. On each Trident are 24 missiles, and on each missile are 8 hydrogen bombs. What happens is the missile gets launched, goes up into space, and there's a bus, this is Pentagon language, with passengers, which are the bombs. And the passengers are dropped off at various points, and they're all very accurately targeted on the missile silos in Russia. So they're the passengers. It's called multiple independent reentry vehicles. The vehicles are the bombs. It's called MIRVing, multiple independent reentry vehicles. So each of these missiles has eight bombs, much larger than the Hiroshima bomb. So I want to show you a Trident submarine just to get a visual image of what I'm talking about. There are enough bombs on these Trident subs to destroy all life in the Northern Hemisphere and much in the Southern Hemisphere. So I'll need... 5 volunteers, and that's you, and you, to come up here. Each page is a missile. Each of these dark pencil-like things are hydrogen bombs that can vaporize a city. A commander on a Trident, if he gets his 2IC to agree, can launch these weapons without communicating with the Pentagon. This is our problem. This will create the final medical epidemic. Thank you very much. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you've just heard a lecture I gave to my medical colleagues in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, in October 2008. As I said previously, it's important that doctors and other members of the medical profession understand the biological and health consequences of the nuclear fuel cycle.
when I first met you, you were so nice and kind. Now you got reckless, you changed your mind. You're a stomp down rider. You're a stomp down rider. You're much too strong.
Was Stomp Down Rider by Australian artist Damon Davies. Thanks for joining us. Visit our website to hear past programs and to donate some money to keep this show on the air. If you love this planet.org. And thanks for listening.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.